Stay safe on the roads with Rain-X Vision Beam Wiper Blades. Now at Menards. For over 40 years, Rain-X has provided drivers with products to outsmart the elements. Their Vision Beam Wiper Blades are easy to install and are designed to provide a smooth, streak-free wipe every time. Save big money on all Rain-X products now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we are opening up really a remarkable file. It tracks one of the most, I guess, improbable career pivots in recent Hollywood history. Mm-hmm. We're going deep on the life and work of William Thomas Hader Jr. Mm-hmm. Our sources lay out this, fascinating, complex narrative.
Yeah.
We're tracing his journey from like a severely anxious kid in Tulsa obsessed with film,
right,
to a failed production assistant through that grueling pressure cooker of Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
All the way to becoming one of modern television's most critically acclaimed directors and, well, auteurs.
That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And our mission today, it's highly targeted. We're really moving far beyond just analyzing the comedian or, the impressionist.
Yeah, right, right.
We're actually tracing the dramatic shift of a genuine multi-hyphenate.
Right.
You've got the actor, the writer, the producer, and the director who basically redefined his whole professional life in his 40s.
Mm.
Yeah, moving away from the, let's say, comfort of sketch comedy into this really demanding terrain of creating, directing, and starring in that tightly structured, darkly beautiful, and just intensely celebrated series, Barry.
And what truly hooks you, the listener, in this story is that defining paradox, right at the heart of his success.
Exactly.
How exactly does a performer who openly struggled with, paralyzing stage fright and intense self-doubt through his entire 8-year SNL run, how does he transition into the kind of demanding creative position that requires, complete confident control?
It doesn't seem possible, does it?
No. We are talking about the man who won consecutive lead actor Emmys for Barry while at the same time collecting Directors Guild and Writers Guild awards for his work behind the camera on the exact same show.
Yeah.
That's not just a successful actor. That's like a total creative takeover.
It really is.
Seemingly executed by someone who spent his life wrestling with anxiety.
It's the ultimate narrative arc, really. And that contrast, that's what gives the achievement its weight, I think.
So just to establish the timeline for everyone, Hader was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 7, 1978.
Okay.
And his foundational ambition, it wasn't comedy at all. It was filmmaking. Specifically, he wanted to be an assistant director.
Right, in 80.
Yeah. So his career is essentially split into these two halves. You've got the reactive performer phase, like 2005 to 2013 at SNL, and then the proactive auteur phase, really cemented by Barry, which ran from 2018 to 2023.
And those accolades, they aren't just vanity metrics, right? They're like institutional proof of this transformation.
Totally.
He locked down those two consecutive primetime Emmys for outstanding lead actor in a comedy series, 2018 and 2019.
Yep.
But maybe more importantly for our deep dive, he started winning DGA and WGA awards. Mm. That confirms his mastery over the, the technical craft of directing and writing.
Which is huge. This is the PA who wanted to be an AD, finally getting that technical respect he always seemed to crave, but like through this entirely unexpected route.
It's an amazing path. Okay, so let's unpack this journey. Let's start right at the very beginning. The roots of his obsession with film and why he initially stumbled so badly.
Let's do it. Trace it back to Tulsa, the Hader household. His father, William Thomas Hader Sr., had one of those truly eclectic American resumes, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Air cargo company owner.
Yeah.
Restaurant manager.
Right.
Truck driver.
And the kicker, an occasional stand-up comedian.
Yeah. It was this wildly varied career path that, looking back, kind of mirrors this sort of multi-hyphenate career Hader Jr. would eventually carve out for himself.
Yeah, totally.
And that eclectic environment, it clearly exposed him early on to some like deep cut comedy and film. His obsessions were pretty sophisticated even back then. Monty Python, classic British comedy, and challenging films of Woody Allen and Mel Brooks.
Right. Not exactly standard kid fare.
Not at all. And he's often spoken about feeling like he didn't quite fit in during those formative years.
Yeah.
He describes himself as always joking around, struggling to focus in class.
Yeah.
And basically retreating into this world defined by the silver screen and books.
So that deep, almost singular film passion drove him toward his first goal, film school.
Right.
But here we hit the first major hurdle, the thing that kind of defines his early life, his grades.
Yeah, the grades.
Our sources reveal he just couldn't get into the top-tier film schools because his academic performance was, and this is his own word, abysmal.
Abysmal. It's such a great self-deprecating word. So he ends up enrolling first at the Art Institute of Phoenix, yeah. then Scottsdale Community College, mm-hmm. just constantly feeling like he was failing the one dream he truly had.
Wow. And the early job history, it definitely doesn't scream future Emmy winner either, does it?
Not exactly. I mean, he worked as a Christmas tree salesman, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a fairly standard side gig. But the detail we love, the one that really stands out, is his time working as an usher at a Tempe cinema. He took that job purely for the free movies.
Of course.
And he was famously fired in 1997 for doing something only like a truly frustrated cinephile would do.
Oh, this is the Titanic story, isn't it?
It is. He spoiled the ending of Titanic for a group of moviegoers he thought were being unruly.
That's incredible. It just perfectly captures that tension, right? Between his genuine reverence for cinema and his, like, inability to just follow the rules sometimes.
Totally. It shows the intensity of his passion, even if it, you know, cost him a minimum wage job.
Right. That passion, that intensity, it fueled his next big step. In 1999, he drops out of college altogether.
Yeah.
And his parents, in this major act of trust and support, let him use the money they'd save for his college education to cover his living expenses in Los Angeles.
Which is huge. A huge leap of faith.
Absolutely. And his mission was singular.
Yeah.
Get to L.A., get work as an assistant director.
So the L.A. years, roughly 1999 to 2004, they're described in pretty stark terms in our sources. He's chasing this dream, right? But living a reality defined by being a... lonely and underemployed.
Yeah.
He talks about working these soul-crushing 18-hour days as a production assistant.
And a PA life?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Grunt work, fetching coffee, managing schedules, leaving absolutely zero time or, frankly, mental energy for any creative ambitions of his own.
Right. You're so close to the dream, physically on set, but completely paralyzed by the exhaustion of just... the grind.
Precisely. It wasn't entirely fruitless, though. He did build up a set of PA credits that show he was working on some major projects.
Okay, like what?
Well, there's the 2004 documentary Empire of Dreams, the story of the Star Wars trilogy.
Oh, cool.
And feature films like James Dean from 2001, Spider-Man in 2002, and Collateral Damage, also 2002. So he was learning the mechanics of filmmaking, just not in film school. You know, he was learning it from the, you know, the brutal ground level up.
Right. But his experience wasn't always, let's say, prestigious set work. He took on a pretty high-risk gig for a bit.
Yeah, briefly. He worked as a PA and stage manager on... Playboy TV's sexual fantasy show, Night Calls.
Wow, okay.
But he quit that job really quickly. Not because of the nature of the work itself, interestingly, but because he was just paralyzed by the fear that it would somehow disappoint his parents back in Tulsa.
That tracks with the anxiety we see later, that fear of letting people down.
Absolutely. And that parental anxiety combined with just sheer professional burnout, It all kind of culminated in 2002. He hit a breaking point while shooting The Scorpion King.
Mm-hmm.
After a particularly bad experience on that set, he just realized, this isn't the life I want, and he quit the PA track completely.
So what did he do then?
He tried to pivot, worked briefly as a nighttime assistant editor, even poured money into making his own short film. But he was apparently so embarrassed by the final result, he thought it was terrible, that he never released it.
Oh, man. Maximum creative frustration right there.
Totally. Rock bottom, creatively speaking.
Okay, so this is where the narrative makes its sharpest, most necessary turn.
The pivot.
After his longtime girlfriend broke up with him in 2003, Hader was, by his own account, desperate for a change. He starts taking comedy classes at Second City in March 2003, almost like a last-ditch effort for some kind of creative engagement.
Right. Not necessarily aiming for a career, just... something.
Exactly. And that was the revelation. The moment he stepped on stage, he realized that comedy, which was dynamic, immediate, didn't require film school grades, that was the true creative outlet he'd been searching for all along.
Wow.
The goal of being a filmmaker hadn't actually changed, but the pathway, the route to get there, it had shifted entirely.
And he channeled that newfound energy, right, into a sketch group.
Yeah, Animals from the Future. And they weren't playing, you know, major venues. They were performing for small, probably rowdy audiences at backyard shows in Van Nuys.
Proper grassroots comedy. That environment probably allowed him to develop his voice without the intense pressure of Hollywood expectations, you know.
Totally. And what's crucial here is how quickly that L.A. comedy community works as a network. Matt Offerman, a member of his sketch group, was the brother of Nick Offerman, who is already pretty established.
Okay, connection made.
Nick tells his wife, the massively popular Megan Mullally, about Hader's raw talent. Mullally sees him perform, recognizes the potential immediately, and makes the critical, life-altering call directly to Lorne Michaels, recommending him for SNL.
Just like that, based on Mullally's recommendation.
Pretty much. But the audition itself, it just captures that anxiety paradox perfectly.
How so?
Well, Hader was nervous, ill-prepared, struggling to showcase his strengths. He felt like he was bombing.
Oh, God.
But out of that anxiety, that panic, he spontaneously improvised an impression of this eccentric Italian man he'd once overheard in a parking lot.
No way.
Yeah. And that improvised character, born literally of panic and desperation, went on to become his recurring SNL character, Vinny Vedecci.
Wow. The breakdown forced the breakthrough.
Exactly. And just like that, the film-obsessed PA who couldn't focus in class lands the most sought-after job in sketch comedy. So let's move into the SNL years, a period defined by, well, immense public success, but also profound hidden anxiety.
Right. So he gets hired as a feature player, makes his debut October 1st, 2005, and his very first live appearance, playing a psychologist.
A psychologist.
Yeah, discussing the emotional aftermath of that scary JetBlue Airways Flight 292 emergency landing. Talk about pressure for a first gig.
Seriously. And he entered the show with a specific goal, right? He didn't want to be the star initially.
Yeah, exactly. He wanted to be what he called a utility player. He modeled his career on his hero, the late, great Phil Hartman.
Okay.
The utility player, in SNL terms, is someone who can just slot into any role, carry any sketch, be the necessary glue. He wasn't aiming for the spotlight at first.
The irony being, as you mentioned, he quickly became known as the impressions guy.
Right, despite having basically avoided celebrity impressions until he was forced into one during that panic-fueled audition.
His impressionist portfolio from SNL is just iconic, though. It's exhaustive.
Oh, yeah. We're talking, what, the deep, booming voice of Vincent Price in those Variety Vault sketches.
Classic.
The chilling tones of Keith Morrison, Harvey Fierstein, Al Pacino, John Malkovich, Charlie Sheen, the list goes on.
He wasn't just doing impressions. He was performing like an audio masterclass every single week.
Totally. And that dedication eventually led to major recognition. In 2012, he was the first male SNL cast member since Eddie Murphy, way back in 86, to get an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series.
That's huge.
Yeah. And his contribution, it went beyond just performance, too. His participation in the show's, you know, razor-sharp political satire during the mid-2000s also earned him and the show a prestigious Peabody Award in 2008.
Mm-hmm. But if we're talking cultural phenomenon from his SNL years, we absolutely have to dedicate some real time to Stefan.
Oh, Stefan, yes.
Yeah.
You can't talk Hader on SNL without Stefan.
The character that became completely synonymous with Hader's time on the show, Stefan, the flamboyant, perpetually overwhelmed weekend update correspondent for New York City culture.
Right. His club recommendations were legendary.
Yeah.
These nightmarish venues staffed by creatures like, what was it, human fire hydrants?
Yes. And places where the main attraction was just getting yelled at by a hobo.
And of course, the running joke that Stefan was madly in love with and married to Seth Meyers.
Always covering his mouth, trying not to break.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is how that character really epitomizes the improvisational magic of SNL. So Sorensen never actually intended to be recurring.
Really?
No. He started as just a single-use joke.
Right.
Simply, David Zaleski's estranged brother.
Wow.
And the character's unique cadence, the visual style, it was all drawn from these real-world, highly specific observations made by Hader and the writer John Mulaney.
Mulaney was key to Stefan, right?
Absolutely key. They met two people who served as the primary inspiration. One was this very distinct-looking barista.
Okay.
And the other was a wannabe club owner who kept inviting Mulaney to these genuinely weird off-the-grid parties.
Mm.
The genius was distilling these specific, awkward social interactions into this beloved recurring character. And Mulaney would apparently change lines on the cue cards right before Hader went live just to make him break.
Which he almost always did. Okay, so while Hader's mastering the live sketch format, his film and voice career is simultaneously exploding.
Yeah, he's not just doing SNL. He makes his feature film debut in Yumi and Dupree in 2006. But his real mainstream recognition arrives in 2007 as the bumbling Officer Slater partnered with Seth Rogen's Officer Michaels in Superbad.
Superbad was huge for him.
Massive. That role just launched him into the public eye,
yeah.
Led to appearances on major platforms like Total Request Live, the VMAs. Suddenly everyone knew who Bill Hader was.
And he became cemented as this highly reliable comedic supporting player, right? Kind of the utility player of the Apatow universe.
That's a great way to put it. He worked extensively with Judd Apatow on films like Knocked Up, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Pineapple Express. Mm-hmm. And he also frequently collaborated with director Greg Motola on titles like Adventureland and Paul.
Right. And then the voice work starts taking off, too.
Yeah, by 2009, he'd already snagged his first lead voice role as Flint Lockwood in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. And he did the sequel, too.
But the work that really prepared him for the, let's say, complex structural demands of Barry, it wasn't actually feature film comedy, was it?
No, this is a crucial, often overlooked piece of the puzzle. It was his collaboration with the creators of South Park.
Right. Tell us about that.
Okay, so starting with the 12th season, Hader begins working as a creative consultant, a producer, and even a voice actor on South Park.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this wasn't just a random gig. It did stem from a friendship with Matt Stone, one of the creators.
Mm.
But Hader specifically sought out the job because he wanted to learn story structure.
Ah, interesting. He recognized a gap in his knowledge.
Exactly. He knew sketch comedy was episodic, structure agnostic, right? A sketch has a setup, a heightening, a blackout, boom, done.
Yeah.
But a serialized story, like Barry would become, requires careful plotting, thematic consistency, understanding pacing, skills he felt he didn't have yet.
So connecting this to the bigger picture of his career, it's the definition of intentional self-improvement. He's already successful on SNL, but he feels this knowledge deficit related to his original dream of filmmaking.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And South Park, with its famously fast and incredibly tight turnaround, basically provided him with a masterclass in how to build a coherent narrative week after week after week.
And he even won an Emmy for it, right?
He did, a 2009 Emmy Award for Best Animated Series as a producer for his work there. And he later rejoined the writing staff for the 17th season. He was genuinely doing his homework, learning the craft he needed for what came next.
That knowledge acquisition was vital because while he was publicly flying high-winning awards, getting film roles internally, the anxiety was just crushing him.
Yeah. He's been remarkably candid about his mental health struggles during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Constant sleep problems, an intense anxiety disorder, feeling neurotic and rigid during those high-pressure SNL years.
Mm.
He constantly feared he had less raw comedic experience than his peers, which created this deep psychological stress before every single live broadcast.
And that pressure finally became physically overwhelming, didn't it? During that final show of 2010.
Yeah. While he was live on air, performing an impression of Julian Assange, he had a full-blown panic attack.
Oh, my God.
He recounted the visceral experience, saying, "It felt like someone was sitting on my chest. I couldn't breathe. I started sweating." He remembers thinking, with terrifying clarity, "This is not good. Abort. Abort."
Just unimaginable on live TV, a public manifestation of his private torture.
Totally. And the fallout could have been career-ending, right?
Yeah.
But the system around him, specifically Lorne Michaels, provided the necessary support.
What did Lorne do?
Recognizing the immense psychological toll of the job, Lorne reassured him afterward with, apparently, immense grace. He told Hader, "You can work here as long as you want."
Wow.
And that statement, according to Hader, offered the deep psychological security he desperately needed at that moment.
That's incredible support.
It is. However, the external demands, specifically the constant travel, flying back and forth to Los Angeles to see his children and his then-wife Maggie Carey, eventually led him to make the decision. He left after 8 seasons in May 2013.
Okay, so he leaves the security of SNL, but not to rest. He pivots dramatically toward the very thing that maybe made him anxious in the first place. Deeper, more vulnerable performance, and eventually full creative control.
Exactly. The post-SNL period, starting around 2014, it's this definitive artistic renaissance. And it seems fueled by his desire for structural control, the thing he learned at South Park.
Mm-hmm.
His first major pivot really demonstrated his commitment to seriousness. He took a dramatic role in The Skeleton Twins in 2014, playing opposite his former SNL castmate, Kristen Wiig.
Great film.
A fantastic film. And it was a critical success, won Best Screenplay at Sundance. It proved Hader could access and convey that deep internal darkness and pathos. People saw a different side of him.
And the success paved the way for his first real leading man role, right?
Yeah.
Albeit in a rom-com.
Yeah, framed within the, let's say, safe confines of a romantic comedy. He starred opposite Amy Schumer in Trainwreck in 2015.
Okay.
Followed quickly by another romantic role in Maggie's Plan. This period established his versatility, ensuring Hollywood saw him as more than just the impressions guy or their quirky sidekick. He was a capable, dramatic and romantic lead.
And then he successfully transitioned back into high-profile genre work, getting significant critical acclaim for playing the adult Richie Tozier in the horror sequel, Chapter 2, in 2019.
Yeah, and his ability there to balance the character's traumatic backstory with the necessary comedic relief showed a real mastery of tonal shifts. That's a skill that would absolutely define his later auteur work on Barry.
Right, balancing the darkness and the comedy.
Exactly. And alongside these on-screen shifts, his voice work portfolio remained robust. He voiced Fear in Pixar's Inside Out in 2015.
Which is kind of perfect casting, isn't it?
Almost too perfect, encapsulating the very emotion he constantly battled in his own life.
Yeah. And then there's the Star Wars thing, which is technically fascinating.
Oh, the BB-8 vocal consultant role for The Force Awakens in 2015. Yeah.
A vocal consultant? What does that even mean?
Well, apparently his voice, along with Ben Schwartz's voice, was manipulated by director J.J. Abrams.
Mm.
But not with complicated post-production magic. Abrams literally used an iPad sound effects app and a talk box.
Seriously? An iPad?
Yeah. To process their vocalizations and create the droids' distinct beeps and boops, it shows Hader's willingness to still be that total utility player, even when his contribution is completely unrecognizable. Just sound engineering, basically.
That's amazing. But the Pixar collaboration didn't last, did it?
No. Both Hader and Mindy Kaling were replaced as voice actors for Inside Out 2. Reportedly, it was due to disputes over compensation.
Oh.
And this is a subtle but, I think, important detail. The utility player who once feared disappointing his parents was now a creative force confident enough in his own value to walk away from a major franchise over pay. Shows growth.
Definitely. Which brings us, inevitably, to Barry, premiering in 2018. This is the moment Hader transitions from that utility player executing other people's visions to a singular auteur.
This is the peak.
Yeah.
He didn't just star as Barry Berkman, the depressed hitman trying to become an actor.
Right.
He was the co-creator with Alec Berg.
Mm.
And critically, he took on the roles of producer, lead writer, and director. He basically mastered the structure he learned at South Park and applied the cinematic grammar he'd obsessed over since childhood.
And the resulting critical acclaim just confirmed the success of this total creative control. He got those two consecutive primetime Emmys for acting, proving his internal dramatic chops.
Yep.
But the true evidence of his auteur status, as you said, lies in the directing and writing accolades. Those demand mastery over the material's form, not just its emotional delivery.
Absolutely. Let's dissect that directorial achievement for a second, because this is where the PA, the guy fired from Titanic, the guy obsessed with Kubrick, finally won, right?
Right.
Hader won multiple Directors Guild of America awards for outstanding directing in a comedy series. The awards were for episodes like Chapter 1, Make Your Mark, the very first one in 2018, which established the whole tone, and later the famous, brutally intense, and just wildly genre-bending episode Ronnie Lily in 2019.
Ronnie Lily is such a standout. It barely felt like a comedy episode.
Exactly. It was less a traditional sitcom episode and more like a short, hyper-stylized action thriller. It showcased Hader's penchant for long takes, complicated fight choreography, stuff that required the precise planning of an assistant director, his original dream.
Wow, full circle.
But executed with the creative ambition of a world-class director. This demonstrated he wasn't just performing, he was building and controlling the entire visual language of the show, blurring the lines between dark comedy, thriller, and action film.
And he didn't just direct, he co-wrote the pilot episode, Chapter 1, Make Your Mark, with Alec Berg, and won a Writers Guild of America award for it.
Yeah, winning in every major creative discipline for the same series. It's remarkable.
Which raises that fascinating question again. How did the anxiety-ridden man master the kind of intense control required to micromanage every single aspect of a show like that?
Well, I think it connects back to the anxiety itself. The paradox suggests that Hader's anxiety maybe wasn't overcome, but perhaps channeled.
How do you mean?
Well, for someone struggling with intense neuroticism and this deep fear of failure, the ability to control the environment, to write the script yourself, direct the scenes, dictate the pace, and then star in the finished product, it becomes a form of necessary psychological armor.
Ah, okay.
If he controlled the structure and the execution, maybe he could minimize the perceived threat of external failure. You know, the auteur status becomes almost a defense mechanism against the panic.
That's a really compelling insight. It explains the meticulous nature of his directing, the precision.
Right. And even while producing and directing Barry, he still found time for smaller passion projects, like starring in that IFC mockumentary series, Documentary Now,
yep,
alongside Fred Armisen and Seth Meyers.
where he could just indulge his love for film history by satirizing different documentary styles.
Yeah.
Total film nerd heaven for him, probably.
Totally. And keeping up his high art connections, he had that very specific, almost covert cameo as a UPS driver in Ari Aster's highly surrealist tragicomedy, Beau's Afraid, in 2023.
Right. Just popped up.
Yeah. And Aster praised Hader for his professionalism, his ability to execute this difficult short role. Again, demonstrating that utility player flexibility is still there when needed.
So looking forward, his focus seems to remain squarely on creation.
Seems so. He's set to voice the titular character and serve as an executive producer for that highly anticipated animated remake of Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat, scheduled for 2026. Mm-hmm. And this commitment to future projects is telling. Notably, because of scheduling conflicts with his current and upcoming creative work, he actually declined the invitation to appear on the SNL 50th anniversary special back in February 2025.
That's a subtle but powerful signal, isn't it? The nostalgia of the past can't derail the focus on the current demanding creative path he's on.
Exactly. He's looking forward, not back. So we've established a successful auteur, but to really understand the depth of his work on Barry, I think we need to examine his source code, like his deep personal influences and interests that clearly informed the sophisticated darkness of that series.
Yeah, let's delve into the brain of the avid cinephile and reader, the man who struggled to focus in school but now apparently devours the classics.
Right. Hader is not a casual fan. He has the film knowledge of, like, a historian.
Yeah.
He consistently cites directors known for complex psychological narratives, sometimes dark aesthetics, specifically the Coen brothers, Stanley Kubrick.
Of course.
And critically, Akira Kurosawa as his major influences.
Kurosawa's interesting.
Very. And this deep, almost scholarly film knowledge led to that remarkable role that validated his passion, hosting Essentials Junior on Turner Classic Movies, TCM, from 2011 to 2014.
Right. And this wasn't just some celebrity stunt casting, was it?
Not at all. TCM specifically chose him because they recognize he really cares and knows the movies.
Yeah.
He wasn't just reading a prompter.
And during his time there, he handpicked, what, 13 films each summer to introduce to younger audiences?
Yep. And these weren't just blockbusters. He chose sophisticated works like the classic musical Singin' in the Rain, the screwball comedy Bringing Up Baby, the British comedy The Lavender Hill Mob, and Kurosawa's masterpiece of narrative ambiguity, Rashomon.
The inclusion of Rashomon is extremely telling when you view it through the lens of Barry, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. Rashomon is famous for its use of unreliable narrators, the inability to ever ascertain objective truth.
Yeah.
Which is a theme that runs so deep through Barry, where characters are constantly lying to themselves and to others about who they really are, what they've done.
It confirms that the passion he developed as that frustrated film student directly informed the intellectual DNA of his acclaimed series. The film school he couldn't get into became the education he gave himself, essentially.
Perfectly put. And his literary tastes, they reinforced this focus on complex existential narratives, too. He's noted that because he felt he didn't really go to college, he felt compelled to catch up on classic literature later in life.
Okay, so who does he read?
He names authors like Tobias Wolff, known for his dark, honest short stories. Fyodor Dostoevsky, the master of psychological and philosophical depth.
Heavy hitters.
Yeah. William Faulkner, famous for complicated narrative structures and those Southern Gothic themes. And the Japanese novelist Junichiro Tanizaki.
Wow. That combination of deep literary and cinematic appreciation, it really explains why Barry's writing felt so sophisticated, so emotionally dense, and often so morally dark.
Definitely. The themes of, you know, professional violence clashing with personal longing, that's straight out of existential literature, just filtered through a modern, very cinematic lens.
Mm. Okay, moving to his personal context, just briefly. It's vital to reemphasize that the anxiety disorder, the sleep problems, the chronic propensity for migraines he talked about during his SNL years. These aren't historical footnotes, right? They're part of his ongoing health narrative.
Right. It provides critical context for the sheer amount of energy and control required to produce a show like Barry while dealing with that stuff. Oh, and he's also known to have a severe peanut allergy, just as a side note.
Right. And on the personal relationship front.
Well, we know he divorced writer and director Maggie Carey back in 2018. They share three daughters.
Mm-hmm.
He subsequently dated actresses Rachel Bilson and Anna Kendrick during his post-SNL pre-Barry peak.
Okay. And his most current relationship detail involves the comedian and actress Ali Wong.
Yeah, with whom he's been in an on-and-off relationship since late 2022. And the most recent human detail about their connection, it came out in April 2025. and it really brings the image of the award-winning director right back down to earth.
What happened?
Well, Hader spoke about the aftermath of those awful January 2025 Southern California wildfires, which tragically rendered his home unlivable.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah. And he shared this genuinely sweet, very relatable anecdote about how Ali Wong comforted him during that incredibly chaotic time and even helped him shop for new jeans because he'd lost so much.
Wow. It just reminds you that the man who can orchestrate complex, dark cinematic violence is, at the end of the day, still someone dealing with very real-world domestic traumas and needing the simple support of a partner, like buying jeans.
Exactly. Brings it all back to the human level.
So we've traced an extraordinary path today, moving from that Tulsa movie nerd who is maybe too anxious to be a good PA, to the acclaimed auteur who directs and writes with this meticulous, almost obsessive control.
Yeah, in summary, the self-deprecating movie fan who got rejected by film schools suffered debilitating anxiety. He eventually channeled his lifelong passion for structure and storytelling directly into his work. His journey is probably the clearest possible testament that deep-seated artistic passion, that cinephile's eye for detail, when combined with a necessary, maybe challenging detour through something like comedy, it ultimately guides and perfects the creative application of the auteur.
Right.
He became the filmmaker he always wanted to be, but only after failing spectacularly to do it the conventional way.
So the final takeaway for you, the listener, seems to be the importance of finding the right creative vehicle, even if that vehicle initially feels like a massive compromise or even a detour. Hader failed at his intended career path, then struggled internally even in his successful career path at SNL. But those failures and struggles eventually gave him the critical tools, the structure from South Park, the timing from SNL, maybe the sheer determination from the PA grind that made Barry possible. His success story is really an ode to the indirect path.
Absolutely. And that leads us perfectly to our final provocative thought for you to consider today. Hader was profoundly influenced by directors like Woody Allen and Akira Kurosawa, masters of blending complex psychological drama with elements of dark comedy or stylized action. Given his tremendous success transitioning from pure sketch comedy and impressions to the tightly structured, morally ambiguous, and often deeply dark narrative of Barry, what does Hader's career trajectory tell you about the future of genre fusion in premium television? Especially when that fusion is driven by a creator with such varied, deep-seated, and frankly meticulously cultivated artistic interests.